You are listening to Uncanny Landscapes, Excursions into the Otherwise, with Justin Hopper.
I'm totally fascinated by houses and the people that lived in them in the past. I've done actually over lockdown looked into the people that lived in this house even more so, and more recent people, and discovering about this lady who escaped Nazi Germany. She was Jewish and lived here from the end of the war till the 60s. It's a secret history, isn't it? Most people who live here never think about that. The feeling that something was left, of all those people were left. It's like my childhood home, you know, you still dream of it. And I'm sure it must be similar for people who've lived here, probably, or grew up here, or lived here for a time as a child. You know, that's always going to be part of them. And yet, these are the rooms that I inhabit.
Welcome to Uncanny Landscapes, a series of conversations around and excursions into landscapes of the otherwise. Each episode features an interview with a landscape practitioner, someone whose work is rooted in the strange ways we today experience our surroundings. I'm your host, Justin Hopper, and you've just heard today's guest, Frances Castle, talking about her passion for the stories of those who've inhabited the spaces she inhabits today. Something she explores musically through her releases as The Hardy Tree and her own record label, Claypipe Music. More from Frances very soon. The music you hear is A Confluence by Andrew Wozelik from Claypipe. Subscribe to Uncanny Landscapes on Substack. It's free and includes the podcast as well as my newsletters of related topics and works in progress. And if you like this stuff, like and subscribe and tell a friend, maybe a few. Over the past decade, few record labels have established an artistic completeness as effectively as Frances Castle's Claypipe. Castle is an artist and illustrator, a musician, and the owner-operator of Claypipe, whose landscape aesthetic has become a genre of its own, unified by her taste in largely instrumental sounds that marry folk, composition, electronics, and a sense of place, as well as her own artwork, which all of Claypipe's releases feature. It's a label that one might call hauntological or psychogeographic in nature, but which has essentially become simply Claypipe-esque. As The Hardy Tree, Castle also creates her own recordings. Meanwhile, Castle illustrates books, creates freelance work, and has embarked on a multi-part, multiple-media project called Stagdale, a graphic novel she writes, illustrates, and produces along with its musical soundtrack. Thanks to Frances and the artists, I've included several Claypipe tracks, partially or entirely, in the podcast, something I haven't done before, but which seems right to give you a taste of the gorgeous landscape music this label releases. Titles and artists are at the end, or in the podcast info. And now, talking about the work Claypipe releases, Frances Castle.
I have to agree with you, it's very hard, because in actual fact, the music that I put out is really quite varied. It's probably, possibly because it's run by one person, the label, and I do all the artwork, and I obviously choose the artists. And the artists are there's quite a range of styles within them. You know, it runs from folk music, like Alistair Roberts and Sharon Krauss, whose records were put out in the past, to quite electronic stuff, synth, experimental electronics. So then there's all kind of in between that as well. There is definitely a connection to place and landscape. Although I think possibly in the future it may move a little bit away from that, because I can't keep repeating myself. And it's really just trying to find the right artist. It's the hardest thing. And presenting them properly. I guess I'm looking for something that's sounding a little bit different from... I get sent a lot of stuff that sounds the same. Obviously, I approach people, but people also approach me. And I'm really always open to people to send me music. But it's I'm sure a lot of labels say this, you know, it's almost like you can tell from the email that they send with the music whether or not it's going to be worth listening to. Just the way they approach you and the way they talk about their music or don't talk about their music, you know, it just, it's whether you can work with someone as well as someone having ideas. And you listen to them, it strikes you straight away. It's difficult to put your finger on it. And it's very difficult for me to step outside and talk about the clay pipe aesthetic. But obviously a lot of it's related to the visuals that I do.
And you began, if I understand correctly, you were doing illustration long before you started putting out music or perhaps even making music yourself. Can you talk a little bit about what you were doing before clay pipe and how it began? And maybe that can feed into our understanding of where that aesthetic comes from.
Well, I started making music way, way back, probably mid to late 90s. Really had no idea what I was doing. I was on a four track and a very early music software. And I did put some records out on smaller sort of indie labels. And then I just stopped doing it for a while. But at that, I think the time when I was putting out the first music was when I was working in computer. I worked in computer games for about 10 years. I actually initially trained as an illustrator. And then obviously when you're in your 20s, it's a difficult, you know, being self-employed is very hard. And so I worked in games for a long time. And then that was kind of when I started doing the music, I think, because obviously that's when I started using a computer. And I'm not musically trained, and I'm not particularly musical either. So everything's a bit of a struggle.
Can I just ask, can you tell us a little bit about what you did in computer games? Because that, I mean, first of all, that's a really sort of interesting period in that kind of stuff. And also, as a separate but related thing, what kind of music you were making for fun and putting out in the 90s alongside that, and when you were starting to learn about computers and such?
Well, I have to say that the computer games that I worked on weren't particularly interesting. I worked for two companies who were doing the early PlayStation games. So I worked on a Die Hard game. I worked on Harry Potter, big computer games, really. In my mind, it was a job, and I was getting paid well for it, but it wasn't particularly creatively interesting to me, really. I was very used to using computers by that point. Because when I was at college, I never used a computer. Everything was hand-drawn at that point. But by this time, I was quite fluent. And obviously then at that point, things like the Sound Blaster cards came out, and you were just starting to be able to produce music on a computer without having to use, say, a sampler or anything like that. But it was still pretty basic. I've used this program called Making Waves, which was like a very basic, it was like a sampler that you could use samples, pitch them up and down on different tracks. And I used to bounce stuff down to a four track. And I actually used to sing, which was pretty out of tune. listening back to it now, it's so crude and lo-fi. And it wasn't even intentionally like that, really. I just didn't know anything. What I was doing, but obviously people liked it, and a couple of small labels. I put out an album, put out some 12-inch singles on an American label called Black Bean and Placenta, and then I've just stopped doing it for a while. And by the time when I came back to it, by that time I'd kind of taught myself Cubase, and I was a little bit more proficient, and I did the first Hardy Tree album then, and that's when clay pipe really started, and it started pretty much just kind of, I don't think I had any plans or any schemes. I was by that time a freelance illustrator. I'd left the games industry. I'd been an illustrator for a while, And the idea was really just to get away from the computer and do some hand printed stuff. So I printed up these CDs, printed up the covers, and it just started from there, really.
But that first Hardy Tree recording, if you can, maybe you could describe what it looks like and sounds like a little bit, because I do feel like that whole, you know, perhaps the first 10 years of Clay Pipe is already sort of forecast within that one release.
Oh, really? That's really interesting. It's a mixture of synthesizers. I think there's acoustic guitar on there. It's very hard for me. There is singing on that record, and after that I just thought, no, I'm not going to sing anymore. It was a record really about my local area, Finsbury Park, and suburban Victorian area. And I'd done a little bit of local history, and I'd started seeing things in layers of past, and also imagining the past. I read about the fields that were there before the houses were built on them. And it just kind of, I found it fascinating. And that record really was about that, an imagined world around that, I'd say.
It's got this very sort of woodcut and woody feel to it, if that makes any sense, and has this feel of the kind of the wilderness outside the suburban back door. Does that ring true to you?
Yes, very much so. Very much that was kind of the ideas behind it. I mean, I think I don't know how long I've been living here when I wrote that, possibly under 10 years, I think. But it was imagining things like Victor. There's even names of people who used to live in the house. Walter Stokes, one of the albums, but that's about a man who was living here during the First World War, who was he was a member. I just researched the house history. I just looked on census returns and found the names of the people who lived here before. And Walter J. Stokes was an astrologer. That was his hobby. He was a member of, because I found like his obituary, he was a member of the Astrologist Society or something like that. He used to go around the UK with glass slides giving lectures in sort of halls and places about the stars. So that song was about imagining him during World War One, when he was living here, just because we're living in the attic flat. I imagined him looking out of the window with a telescope looking at the stars. So that's about that record, that particular track.
And can you tell me a little bit, so you're in the same place now as you were when the label began?
Yes, yeah.
Can you tell me, when you look out the window that I see behind you, what kinds of things do you see? What is it like there?
I can see more Victorian houses on the other side of the road. Beyond that, there's an old Victorian school which wasn't there then. Beyond that is a big new shopping centre, and they built more flats around the station, which are quite high.
So, So there is that kind of psychogeographic feel of that layered feel to it in
Yes,
that kind of
yes. I
place.
think I was becoming aware of things like of that kind of thing when I started that record. And actual fact, that book, the record was quite inspired book by Gillian Tyndall. She wrote a book called about Kentish Town. I can't remember the name now, but it was had a similar. It was called, oh God, I have to look it up. Because
Is it called The Fields Beneath?
the fields beneath, and the fields lie sleeping underneath was written was some graffiti that was written on a squat somewhere in Kentish Town, which so I nicked that for the album for the name of the album title. Although it's not Kentish Town is a couple of miles away, but I think the story of it was quite similar to around here. So I was very interested in that book.
And that's the first release, and that's the Hardy Tree, which is you. So actually, I don't even know. Is there anyone else who's quote unquote in the Hardy Tree?
I think there was another guy, Lee McFadden, who played guitar on that, only on one track.
Right. But it's
And oh, I
essentially
had
your
someone play
project.
violin, but
Okay.
yes, yeah.
And then how does that, you know, that's a sort of obvious thing for an artist to do, you know, build a look and a feel and name a label and everything to release your project. How does that then translate into starting to put out other people's work, which is, I would imagine, the sort of daunting, I've never done it, but a daunting task.
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it? Because obviously I've been asked this a lot, and it's very hard. I had no master plan, and but I think I gave that I gave that a number, a catalogue number one. So I think I had it in the back of my mind that I would do more. And at that point, I think there was very much MySpace time. When that was a great time. Looking back, it was a great time. It was almost like when a lot of kind of artists who that I'm into now or that are related to the label were around, and we all linked up. People like July Skies, I don't know if you know their music, Glenn Johnson at Second Language, Michael Tanner. There seemed to be a group of people who were interested in similar things. Tyndall House, which has just been reissued, I kind of at some point wanted, I found that on MySpace and wanted that to be the second release. And then Glenn Johnson was putting it out, so that was sort of pushed back. So I put out Thalassing by Michael Tanner and Kerry Robertson, which became the second release. And then me and Glenn then decided to put out Tyndall House together, which worked really well actually, because Second Language already had quite a following, and I was able we split the release, and that he kind of did the sort of sending out and packaging things, and I did the graphics. So I can't remember how many we did first of all, and it was just a CD.
It says
And
on the website, it says 300 copies, CD and cassette.
Oh, we did quite a lot then. That's quite a lot, really, wasn't it? I think that was from having Second Language on board, because Glenn had already quite a he had quite a following.
And all of those had these, you know, like you said, with the Second Language collaboration, you did the graphics,
Yeah.
and I assume, I know that you've done at least almost all of, if not all of the clay pipe visual language. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think the only one that's had other work on, or perhaps a few have, but Darren Heyman's Lido, I did the cover and he did all the illustrations inside it of all the Lidos. But pretty much, yeah, that's pretty much the thing, you know, if
And
you
sorry.
that's the thing that holds everything on clay pipe together is my artwork, really. Yeah.
And it strikes me that, you know, in these, certainly in the early pieces, but I think there's this visual language that runs through it that, stop me if I'm totally off base, but I'm going to guess that there's a this sort of 20th century British landscape art aesthetic that has fed into that with sort of John Piper and Revillius
Yeah.
and that sort of work. And a lot of it is kind of fed through. Again, this is just off the top of my head, and I'm not an expert by any means, but it seems to me that it's been fed through a kind of pop art slash early 21st century, not filter, but through the eyes of someone
I
who
hope so. I
that.
hope so, actually, because I don't want to think that I'm just kind of replicating those old guys. Because I'm never going to do them justice, really. And I obviously, I want to add a bit of my own self into it, at my own time. And obviously, that's the world I live in now. They're all produced digitally. They're all produced on an iPad. There's no real paint involved, which is just the way most illustrators work today. So I don't think there's anything wrong in that, really. So hopefully, yeah, I don't want to just be replicating the old guys. But you know, I think another thing that happened around that time of the first few records was I was discovering all that work, like a lot of people were at that time. I think that they've been kind of looked over, those are all those artists, and it just slotted in with all the music that I was listening to, and it just su suddenly came sort of all came together. So yeah, I think, you know, as well as obviously the label's been around for a long time now, I think 12 years, and I'm reaching the point where I'm thinking I can't keep repeating myself, you know, I have to sort of move on a little bit. So we'll see what happens in the next year or so. I hope things are gonna maybe change a little bit. I don't know.
Well,
I haven't even got a lot of plans for the future, to be honest, at the moment. So we'll see. We'll
the
see.
new thing that's coming out in a few days, the Ziggurat,
Yeah.
is that how I say it?
You know, I'm really not sure. I'm really not sure how
Okay.
you pronounce it. I've
But
just got one here. Yeah.
that's that's that feels like an interesting development visually
I
because
think so.
it
I
still
have.
feels the same to me, is the funny
Yeah.
thing.
Well, I have done more ab some more abstract stuff previously. I have done stuff for Kate Brooks. Quite a lot of the stuff I've done for her is more abstract. Unfortunately, sometimes I feel under pressure that the artists themselves are going to be expecting a typical clay pipe cover. And so it has to be, you know, the right person. So, you know, I'd like to do something a little bit different here, maybe that's not a sort of fully illustrated image. Yeah, and I hope, you know, it is a very graphic image, but I think it does still have the same aesthetic, you know.
Thank you. the other thing to me, if maybe you can riff on this for a moment, is that some of these covers, and now I'm blanking on titles, so let me just cheat really quickly. The Railway Carriage.
Gilroy Mayer.
Yeah, both the Gilroy Mayers, in fact. And or all three, I suppose. Shapwick and a few of these projects, they have this visual language that to me feeds directly into that other one, despite being very different in a lot of ways, which is a kind of noir kind of pulp, you know, kind of pulp detective. You know, there's this feeling on those that something is slightly off, despite it appearing perfect.
I think with the two Gilroy Mayer ones, I started with the Green Line with the black face looking out. I was quite nervous about that, actually, and what Ollie was going to say when I showed it to him, because I thought it was quite different to some of the other stuff. And perhaps with a Green Line bus, maybe people are expecting like a very cheerful image of buses and I don't know. But obviously there was a slight darkness there with the face that you can't see looking out. So I was a little nervous about how he'd react to it, but he liked it. So, and it's a popular cover. People seem to like it. So yeah, I think that's one of my favourite ones, actually. And we did a similar thing with the second album, Adelstrom, you know, which was based around a poem.
Yes, I remember Adelstrom, the name. Because one afternoon of heat, the express train drew up there unwantedly. It was late June. The steam hissed. Someone cleared his throat. No one left and no one came on the bare platform. What I saw was Adelstrop, only the name. And willows, willow herb and grass, and meadow sweet and haycocks dry, no whit less still and lonely fair than the high cloudlets in the sky. And for that minute a blackbird sang close by, and round him, mistier, farther and farther, all the birds of Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire.
If I can talk a little bit more about this sort of visual theory about these kind of, to me, noirish kind of images combined with these Revilius-like images. And I think Revilius himself had this in what he was doing, as certainly did John Piper, to mention those two in particular. But it's almost like, to me, it's almost like this false idyllic thing, this kind of hearty nostalgia for this utopian kind of British English landscape, but done from the point of view of someone who knows that never existed.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that rings true with you at all, and if you might talk a little bit. You know, it just always strikes me as funny that people like perhaps you, but certainly myself, who have a very cynical view of a lot of this nostalgia, also absolutely adore things like Revilius. Does that ring true with you? And if so, can you talk to it a little bit?
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I mean, definitely, because Revilius and Piper are not just painting the landscape as something beautiful and chocolate boxy, are they? There's definitely a lot more there than that. But it's hard to put your finger on exactly what it is. You know, you've got a beautiful painting of a chalk course, but still it says there's something more there, but it's how do you put your finger on it? It's that kind of thing. And it's obviously that sort of thing that's I think perhaps they were forgotten for a long time, or they were overlooked for a long time, those artists. Perhaps it's something we only see now that makes them. It's very hard to say for me, and to look at my art, compare it to them in any way as well, because they're so great. But yeah, I think you're right. There is something. There's a darkness there. There's something else. I'm not interested in just drawing a nice picture of a landscape painting, putting it on the front of the album covers. It's never going to be quite that, you know.
And it's one of the reasons that I was thinking that this first Hardy Tree record actually sort of foreshadows what's going to happen for several releases, because the title, The Fields Lie Sleeping Underneath, you know, it implies all of that. And I always, you know, I'm thinking about Paul Nash, who does it much more directly, right?
And
your work kind of feels like the way, like the difference between Paul Nash and John Nash to me is that Paul Nash kind of telegraphs to you that there's something wrong here, and John Nash lets it sit for 50 years before you realize it.
Well, maybe wasn't John Nash more of a kind of illustrator than his brother? I don't know. I'm not sure. I think it's very, yeah. I mean, there's definitely, there's a huge, I mean, there's a huge, they're not like the Victorian landscape painters, do you know what I mean? Who just painted beautiful pictures of the British landscape. That there was definitely something different in that generation. And it may have been the First World War, I don't know. That had happened, you know, at that point. And people had started to, you know, nature, the countryside was, you know, was being mechanicalized. So I don't know. I'm sure there's an art critic who could put it better than me, but I think there was a change at that point, definitely.
It just feels interesting to me that those kinds of works, and especially when kind of, you know, seen as an inspiration to an artist like yourself, when those, you know, when they regain traction like they have recently, and like your work has, there's, you know, there's an underlying reason, and it's because we can't put our finger. I guess that's what a lot of people mean when they talk about hauntology, not to bring up that word, but you know, is because you can't put your finger on it, can you?
No.
Can't actually say why there's something. Like, the music you put out is, many people would hear it as simply beautiful music. But I think a lot of people hear it and think there's a darkness. Not a darkness. There's another side to this.
Yeah.
There's something else.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
Can we use... So I'm biased because I'm absolutely obsessed with the last two Andrew Wesolek albums that you put out. And my three favorites, I'll just say, for nobody asked, but my three favorites on the label are those two and Common Grounds.
Oh, right.
Which are all in the past 2 years, I think, or 3 years, maybe.
Yeah.
But could you use maybe something like the Wasilek, like the Balgay Hill is an album by a Scottish artist whose name I always forget, who goes by Andrew Wasilek. This came out a couple of years ago, and it's maybe my favorite album of the past few years. And maybe you could just use that as an example of telling us what the clay pipe process is. I mean, how does something come into you? What then happens, and how does it get out into the world for a one-woman label, essentially?
Well, actually, Andrew had approached me, I think, a couple of years before, and I don't know what happened, but it didn't happen. I think it's probably just timing, because I liked what he was doing and I kept an eye on him. And I think it was something that I regretted not doing. I thought I should have worked with him on that record, and I don't know why it never worked out. It certainly wasn't because I didn't like the music, but I think it was just a timing thing where I just had too much on, or he I can't remember, but it didn't happen. And then he approached me again with Ball Gay Hill. And I thought, this is great. You know, straight away, obviously, I knew I wanted to do it. So Andrew is very well organized. And he's a professional musician. So it was great working with him, and it was a learning process for me as well. I think we planned it quite far ahead. It was at the time when pressing was getting really difficult, so we had to wait a long time for the record to come out. And the cover, I think I worked on the covers. The trouble with covers is sometimes they come really quickly, and sometimes it can take me weeks. You know, it can take me weeks to come up with an idea. And I think this was a slow one for me. I played around with Andrew sent me photographs at Ball Gay Park. He went out and just took lots of photos. Some of them made more of the inner sleeve, because he took a lot of photos of trees with graffiti on, but also the observatory, which I think is probably the most well-known iconic part of the park. So I've never been to the park. As far as I know, there are no magnolia trees. That was just complete artistic license that worked to frame the image. So I should explain to the listeners that the cover has a magnolia leaves on it. It's called Ball Gay Hill Morning Magnolia. And then there's a picture of the observatory behind this tree in the morning sunlight. In fact, there's three different versions, because we did three different pressings of it over time, each with a different, slightly different coloured magnolia tree. And
Ball Gay Hill is a park in, is it Glasgow or Edinburgh?
It's in Dundee.
Oh, sorry, yeah, my bad, Scottish Dundee. Friends.
yeah, so Ball Gay is the name of the park. Yeah, that's right. The album was basically about lockdown and about Andrew's experience. Andrew lives near the park, so it's about his experience of going to the park and walking in the park over lockdown. And it's just really a beautiful record.
And is it, when what comes into you? I mean, does he hand you a completed record?
I think initially he sent me what was nearly completed. So it was a rough kind of mix, and I think he might have added a couple of tracks and taken a couple of tracks away. I left him pretty much to it. That's not always the case. Quite often I work quite closely with the artists to get track listings right, and it all depends on the artist and the record. But Andrew's records, both of them, were just perfect when he gave them to me, so there was nothing, we didn't need to do anything.
Can you tell me a little bit about the work that you do as a freelance illustrator? Yes. outside of something like Clay Pipe?
Yeah, well, I work with an agent who I've been with for a long time, I think over 15 years now. And so like all freelance work, it ebbs and flows, you know. I do book covers, kids' books I've done. Actually, a lot recently. I'm actually just working on at the moment some banners for a shopping centre, which are going to be all about films. So I'm halfway through that job at the moment. And I previous to that, I've done some that's like for a park. It's hard to explain exactly, but they're like metal toys for kids to play on in a park. I don't think that's, I've finished the illustrations, but I don't think they're in the park. That's going to be in Plymouth. I've just previous to that, I did some book covers for an American publisher. I've got
Can you tell us one book that just stands out in your memory? Or
yeah, I think the
so that we can look at it.
Favorite book that I've ever done is can I just, because I'm so bad at names. And
oh yeah, yeah. Look it up. I do the same thing all the time.
I think my memory's going a little bit.
Well, if you're anywhere near my age, that's just what happens, I'm afraid.
I'm sure I am near your age. Yeah, Folk Tales of Britain and Ireland by Kevin Crossley Holland. I did that probably 5 years ago now, and that was an absolute favourite. I hope to be doing some more stuff like that, but those sort of jobs are hard to come by. But that was, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at your website now instead of just Clay Pipes, and there's so many things. You must be incredibly busy.
Well, these are over a long period of time. You know, like anything, I had a very quiet period over lockdown, which was good for the label. And I'm having to juggle both, really. I'm due at some point to start a big kids' book project. And I signed a contract for it last year, and as yet I haven't started it. And I am a little bit concerned how I'm going to juggle those two, that with Clay Pipe. I think it's going to last a while, so we'll have to see. But yeah,
and it must be because Clay Pipe is very successful in many ways. I can't imagine you're making loads of money.
No.
It must essentially be a have to take a back seat at times.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately illustration's not particularly well paid either. So the label, you know, it doesn't lose money, I have to give it that. You know, it ticks along quite nicely. We'll just have to see what happens in the future. I think people are buying less records this year. I've noticed a bit of a downward fall, and I've had all the problems with pressing plants, but that seems to be getting better now. So I'll just have to see. I think, I think possibly getting the numbers right of how many records to press each time is important. We'll just have to see next year how things pan out. But
you obviously, I mean, looking at the Wozlik things, you know, the Balgay Hill looks like there were 2,000 LPs of it,
and I think we did
your firstlings were like 100 copies, so.
I think we did, yeah, we nearly did 2,000 on that one's gone. The last record we did I think it was 1,700 in all. And there's still copies of that around, but I think Andrew's touring all the time. You don't want all records just to sell out. So if people want them, they can get them. You want them to be available. I've been going on that premise a bit more this last year. And if the records are there, people can get them. It's just a thin line between doing too many that people are never going to want, and then selling out and people missing out and not being able to get them, and then people on Discog selling them for crazy prices. But yeah. it, you know, it's a weird
That's annoying.
It's a just a juggling act to get the right amount. And I think the amount fluctuates with how people have, I mean, obviously at the moment people are feeling hard up, a lot of people aren't spending money, whereas during the pandemic people were going crazy for vinyl. People were getting, you know, getting money off the government, or they were still getting paid for jobs that they weren't really having to do. They were spending a lot of time at home and they had lots of time to invest in sitting down and listening to vinyl. So I think records are really well over that period.
And that must have been part of what happened with the last Hardy Tree album as well. That must have begun its gestation during that period, I imagine. Can you tell me a little bit about that, which is a record I'd love to play some of in this podcast, if you'll let me?
Yeah, of course. Yes, that was pretty much really a lockdown record. And in a way, the subject matter was similar to the first LP, but I think I was looking at smaller things, smaller details, things like, but also it was based on walks that I was doing, and I'm just noticing smaller things, you know, singular buildings or even just parts of buildings.
And the titles are all very much, you know, they're painting titles essentially. So are they actually, you know, inspired by these specific, you know, mist on the playing fields, shop fronts and parked cars?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. I just, you know, like a misty day in the park up the road, Finsbury Park, was the inspiration for that. And then there's one called Seaford Crescent, which is a really strange little, up on Highbury the other way, which is quite a wealthy area, but there's this little tiny cutting where you go in and half of it's an old very large Victorian house, and the rest of it is like a council blocks that have been built around it. Just a sort of a strange mystical place to me when I was doing my walks. I always imagined someone looking out the window of this Victorian house, possibly some sort of someone that used to live there. Don't know. And that's where that song, that track, particular track came from. Fascinated by houses and the people that lived in them in the past. You know, I've done over lockdown, looked into the people that lived in this house even more so, and more recent people, and discovering about this lady who escaped Nazi Germany. She was Jewish and lived here from the end of the war till the 60s. And I presume at that time the house was, it's flats now, but I think at that time probably would have been like a room, or you rented a floor, because it's not divided up per se as addresses. It's still one address, but there's multiple people living in the house. So I presume that's how it worked in those days. And yeah, just that, in fact, there was a lot of Jewish people living in the area at that point, refugees. So I've found all that kind of, you know, it's almost like a secret, it's a secret history, isn't it? Most people who live here never think about that. But I became quite the feeling that something was left of all those people were left. It's like my childhood home, you know, you still dream of it. And I'm sure it must be similar for people who've lived here, probably, or grew up here, or lived here for a time as a child. You know, that's always going to be part of them, and yet that these are the rooms that I inhabit. So I find that something totally intriguing.
I wanted to ask also one last thing is for you to tell us just a little bit about Stagdale, which strikes me as such a, you know, to me it seems like such a daunting task to do this multimedia sort of, you know, in the original sense of the phrase, you know, multiple media as opposed to multimedia. So can you tell everyone what that is and just briefly about it?
It actually came about strangely because I started doing a few short stories, short graphic stories, like graphic novel type stories, like comics. And I did a couple of 4 or 5 pages short stories. And my agents took this round to some publishers. And there was a kids publisher who was kind of interested in me doing something. And I went for a meeting with them. And they came up with an idea that I thought was a bit lame. And they said, oh, you know, if you have any other ideas, let us know. So I took their initial idea and came up with a basic idea of Stagdale. And then I did some pages for them to take around. I think they like to take stuff to trade shows and just get feedback. But they wanted the male and the lead role. They wanted it to be set now. They wanted all these things. So I was quite restricted over what I could do. And so they took I did them some ideas. They took them around and they had them for about a year. And then they said, oh, this is not, you know, this is going to happen. So then I was kind of like, well, do I leave this here and just not think about it anymore? Or do I do something based around this idea that I've come up with, but totally in a way that I want to do it? So that's kind of what happened. So I've done 2 books so far. It's a story set in the 1970s in a village, and also set during the Second World War, also in the same village. And there's 2 children, it's a generation apart. They're both come into this English village as strangers. So the little boy is a refugee that arrives on the kinder transport, and the girl in the 70s arrives with her mother after her parents' divorce. And it's a kind of, I suppose, adventure story, and there's a missing jewel. That's about as far as I've got. I mean, the story is all planned out, but as far as the 2 volumes that I've done so far, that's about all far I've got. I'm working on the 3rd one. And it's like, if I have a long period without much illustration work, I can really start getting on with it. And also if clay pipe's a bit quiet, then I get on with it. But I did do a lot beginning of this year, and since then I've been too busy. So literally when it gets quiet, I can do it. And then
there's a third, you know, obviously you're writing this, you're illustrating it, you're producing it, but you're also soundtracking it in a way.
Yeah. So there's music that goes with each one. There's 3 tracks. And the initial copies come with a flexi disc of one of the tracks, and then a download for the others. So that's kind of set. Yeah, that's a huge amount of work. So I have no idea when I'll finish it. I hope that I'd love the third one to be out this year, but I just don't know how busy I'm going to be. The next album is a new Vic Mars record that'll be out at the end of the year, autumn time. And then next year, it's kind of like, it's still in the planning stages really for next year. We'll have to see.
Yeah. Great. Well, we love Vic Mars, so that's great news.
Yeah, and I think it's his best record yet. It is really good. I'm really excited about coming out. So
excellent.
Yeah.
Well, let me know and we'll re-up the people.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Uncanny Landscapes. We'll be back soon with the next installment. My guest has been Francis Castle of Clay Pipe Music. claypipemusic.co.uk. The music in this episode included A Confluence by Andrew Wazelek, Walter R. Stokes by The Hardy Tree, Saxon Chapel by Tynham House, Broken Circle by Ziggurat, Adelstrop by Gilroy Near, Sun Caught Cloud Like the Belly of a Cat by Andrew Wazelek, The Spire of St. Mary's by The Hardy Tree, Face in the Window, Seaforth Crescent by The Hardy Tree, Stagdale in the Snow by The Hardy Tree, and Holloways by Vic Mars, which is playing now. The Uncanny Landscape's title theme is by the Bellbury Poly, and our icon is by Stefan Musgrove. I'm Justin Hopper. Follow me on Instagram at Old Weird Albion, and subscribe to this podcast's cousin Substack, helpfully also called Uncanny Landscapes. And finally, all the links I've just mentioned are on the Uncanny Landscapes site, uncannylandscapes.podbean.com. More installments coming soon. If you've enjoyed this and other episodes, please subscribe to the Substack and like, rate, and share the podcast, or just tell a like-minded friend or two. And until next time, remember the words of Basho. Winter desolation, in a world of one color, the sound of the wind.